So welcome to our fourth and last sort of formal session of the day. The title of this session has changed a bit. When it started, the first title I had for the session originally was called Design for Tolerance, and Nicholas couldn't tolerate that one. He said that tolerance is kind of a weak word. It's a negative word. It's about putting up with something, that you wanted something stronger. So when I was trying to redesign the title, I came up with what we are now using as a title, which is Cooperation Without Coercion. But interestingly, somewhere along the way, as we were making our different versions of the website and the booklet you have here, the title somehow got changed to Designs for Coercion, and which I think is a really interesting and provocative title, because one of the questions that has come up on the Twitter stream a couple of times today has been people saying, can someone just define what you mean by hyperpublic? And so Betsy has been sort of the closest to that, and she said, well, hyperpublic is living like Paris Hilton. I wasn't really thinking of sort of Paris Hilton particularly with the word hyperpublic, but I think this is, one of the big questions that's been underlying everything here is we've talked a lot about how do we sort of retain some kind of privacy, how do we retain the things that we have, while technologically there really is this feeling that there is this sort of this inevitable barreling forward into a world that really is a lot more public, and technology really is changing things, and that, well, we can talk about norms, we can talk about laws and everything, but we really are living at a time of vast societal cultural change because of these technologies. And I think that that's part of what we want to really address in this fourth session is, well, what are some of the things that we want as a society? Maybe they're the things that we're afraid are going away with this. And the issue of cooperation is one that I think is very much at the heart of the issues around privacy, because one argument is that it's only through having a level of privacy that we can really cooperate with each other, that by hiding what we really think of others allows us to have a cooperative society. And the other is that it is the coercion implicit in being in public all the time that makes the society perhaps not very free, but certainly coherent and cooperative. And so that's some of the tension we will look at here. Our three speakers here are Charlie Nesson, who's here at the Berkman Law School and one of the co-founders of the Berkman Center. Martin Nowak, who is a theoretical biologist looking at, among other things, the mathematics and models behind cooperation. And Nicholas Negroponte, who's the founder of the Media Lab and most recently has been working on the One Laptop Per Child project about bringing technologies to, such as we've been talking about today, to children throughout the world. So I will start with Charlie, and thank you.
Well, before I founded the Berkman Center with John Zittrin, I asked Nicholas Negroponte for advice about whether he thought it was a good idea. And he said that he thought the future of cyberspace would be built of law and engineering. And I regarded that as just tremendously perceptive. You see the reflection of it in a different form in Larry's perception of the relationship of law and code. I've totally enjoyed being here at this conference. And the question that has permeated through to me as I've listened to Judith, among others, speak about our space is, who are we? We talk about the public. What is our public space? And in asking that question, who are we? I was completely taken by Jeff Huang's presentation, in which, from an architect's point of view, it appeared that he had been given the perfect hypothetical, a desert in which to build both the public space and the private space. And this thought when you ask, who are we, comes back to a question that Jonathan and I posed when we started the Berkman Center, which is, are we capable of governing ourselves? Well, let's ask, what is our domain? Ours is the public domain. Ours is the common knowledge that one can access and reach through the net. We are we the people. We're we the people of Massachusetts, of the United States of America. But in cyber terms, most fundamentally, we are the people of the net. Well, what then is our domain? Our domain is the public domain. And if one is to build the public domain in a way that is articulate, that meets the question, what is the public domain, then I believe that the wisdom to follow, from a lawyer's point of view, is the same wisdom that's more or less informed the world of real property. If you want an orderly world of real property, you build a registry. If you want an orderly world of digital bits, you build a registry. And so I want to describe to you a project that we're currently embarking upon, which is to build a registry of the public domain. We're not planning to do it all at once. The plan is to start with the Petrucci collection. I urge you, those of you on the net, to Google it, to go to it. The IMSLP collection, imslp.org, the International Musical Score Library Project. What you'll find is a beautiful site which collects 93,000 musical scores that are in the public domain. It's a public domain collection, exquisitely put together by a young man named Edward Gao, presently at 2L at Harvard Law School. Remarkable. The thought is, build a registry for the public domain. If you think of cyberspace, one way to think, as the bits you can reach through the net. They divide into two domains, the domain that you can reach for free and the domain that's not free. Not free by copyright, not free by market, not free. And when we ask, who are we as people of the public domain and what can we do, I believe that we can build our domain and build it on a foundation that is solid in law. So the thought is to build a registry in which, imagine the structure, you have an underlying registry which is a declaration of the public domain status of the works that are registered. And you have links to the collections held by registrars, librarians, people who build structures of metadata that are increasingly interoperable. And if you imagine that registry being populated, not just by IMSLP, but by other librarians with public domain collections, then you have a registry of considerable dimension. But the problem with registries has to do with litigation risk. This is a legal world that is impacted by the threat of lawsuit. And so the essence of this idea of a registry is to couple the registrar with a pro bono commitment of legal service from a law firm of repute to defend litigation based on infringement against the registrar, the registry, and the users of the registry. That is to say, the structuring of a legal foundation which positively defines the public domain and defends it. Now, you may say, how does this connect with privacy? I believe it connects to privacy right through the piece that David Weinberger suggested. If you ask, institutionally, what are the great institutions of the world that appreciate individual privacy? You look to government, you don't find it. They're interested in surveillance. You look to corporations, you don't find it. They're interested in data acquisition. You look to librarians, you start to find allies. And the librarians themselves are part of greater institutions. So the possibility of actually building strength at an institutional level amongst a federation of nonprofit institutions, each in their way a conservator of their public domain, the heritage of their nation. This has the potential of an institutional force in support of the public domain, which is powerful and which shares the values of privacy, as vague as they may be. But at least someone on your side to be working them out. Thank you.
It's an interesting note, this combination of the library as a center for both the respect for privacy and also for public space. It's a combination that in many ways we're not seeing, and it's interestingly balanced, marked with the architecture. It's interestingly marked with the architecture we saw earlier at the Seattle Museum of Seattle Library as this beautiful open glass space. And I just was going to ask you if you could say something about this combination from perhaps from a legal perspective or in general of a commitment to public space and privacy. Is it something you see primarily in libraries, or do you think there's a inherent link between them?
I'm tough on privacy, Judith. I've never liked it. I've always felt as a concept it was kind of grounded in fear.
We're missing.
The law of it has always seemed like a kind of a rear guard action, you know, to appease the people in the face of advancing technology. It's always seemed like what's coming out of the back end of the judicial system, rather than the forward-thinking architecture of the public space, which within it allows private space. That suddenly starts to make sense to me.
Okay, we're missing Adam here, who is the strong proponent of not saying that privacy is about fear. And I promised that we'd have a big debate about that. I don't see him, but we will come back to that thought when he returns to the room. So thank you. Are there any quick questions for Charlie or right now? Okay, so let me go on to Martin, and then we'll do questions as a whole. I think we're having a sort of afternoon lull. So, but
so I'm a mathematical biologist here at Harvard, and before I begin my talk, I would like to tell you what a mathematical biologist is, and it's best explained with a short story. So there's a shepherd and a flock of sheep, and a man comes by and says, if I guess the correct number of sheep in your flock, can I have one? And the shepherd says, okay, try. So the man looks and says, 83. And the shepherd is completely amazed because it's the right number. So the man picks up a sheep and wants to walk away. The shepherd says, hang on, if I guess your profession, can I have my sheep back? Okay, try. You must be a mathematical biologist. How did you know? Because you picked up my dog. So in my field, it's important to get the numbers right. And today, I'm talking about the evolution of cooperation, which is a very big topic because Darwinian evolution is based on natural selection, and natural selection is a struggle for competition. And in such a struggle, the question would be, why would we ever help anybody else? Why should I reduce my own fitness, so to say, to increase the fitness of somebody else? And that's the problem of evolution of cooperation. So in the atomic interaction here, we have two people, say, or two cells, you know, but let's talk about people here. And one is a donor, and the other one is a recipient. The donor pays a cost, and the recipient gets a benefit. And cost and benefit are measured in reproductive success, and reproduction can be genetic or cultural. So we use the same framework to describe, say, people learning how to behave without genetic reproduction. We talk about cultural evolution then. So if you have this framework, and if both people have to make a choice simultaneously between cooperation and defection, we get a very famous game. It's a game in the sense of game theory, a field of mathematics that was invented by John von Neumann. And so what you see here is that my choice and your choice, and then what is written in red is what you would get if these were the outcomes. So you have to look at this payoff matrix, and now you have to decide for an action, either to cooperate or to defect. And I will also decide between cooperation and defection, so we will play the game simultaneously. So please look at the matrix and make a choice. Who wants to cooperate with me? Raise your hand. Who wants to defect? Very few defectors, so many people haven't actually decided, so I should say this is not an optional game. In game theory, we also have optional games where there's a third column, which means do nothing. But this is not a prisoner's dilemma, so you have to make a choice, essentially. So this is how you should think about it. You don't know what I will do. Let's assume I cooperate. If I cooperate, you have a choice between B minus C and B. So B is greater than B minus C, because B greater than C greater than zero. So if I cooperate, you want to defect. If I defect, you have a choice between minus C and zero. So zero is greater than minus C, so if I defect, you also want to defect. Therefore, no matter what I might be doing, it is better for you to defect. And now, if I analyze the game in the same way, we both end up with defection, we both get 0 points, and then we're very disappointed because over there, we would have had B minus C points had we both cooperated. And that's precisely why it's called a dilemma. So the dilemma is that there's an incentive to defect, but two cooperators are better than two defectors. For the group, it is better to cooperate, but for the individual, there's always the temptation to defect. And that's the problem here. And what I gave you is the so-called rational analysis that is offered by game theorists and economists to say that you cannot cooperate in the prisoner's dilemma, as written here. But we have seen that people cooperate, that this is also borne out in experiments. So the question is, why do people cooperate? I should say that as biologists, we analyze the game slightly differently. We don't need the concept of rationality. What I gave you was this rational analysis, and a rational player is defined in the game theory sense as somebody who realizes what the Nash equilibrium is and plays the Nash equilibrium, but most experiments show that people are not rational. So the interesting thing is biologists don't make use of that concept, but come to the same conclusion. So if we have a mixed population of cooperators and defectors, a defector always has a higher payoff than a cooperator. So therefore, defection becomes more and more popular because this is how you make money. You make more and more money until everybody is a defector and the system breaks down. So here, natural selection destroys cooperation, opposes what would be good for the population, and leaves the population in a state of just defection. So therefore, natural selection needs help to favor cooperation over defection. And this help is something that I summarize in 5 mechanisms. So there has been work on this over the last 40 years, and there have been many hundreds or thousands of papers actually written on this, and I categorize these papers as belonging to 1 of 5 mechanisms. And these mechanisms are kin selection, direct reciprocity, indirect reciprocity, spatial selection, and group selection. And for the purpose of this meeting here, I want to discuss direct and indirect reciprocity, if I have time, a little bit about spatial selection. I'm happy to take questions about the other mechanisms also. So direct reciprocity is the idea, I help you, you help me. And this was written in an important paper by Robert Rivers in 1971. So direct reciprocity leads to the so-called repeated prisoner's dilemma. We play this game that we just played not once, but several times. If we play it several times, it is no longer the case that the best thing is just to defect. Because if I defect with you in the first round, that might upset you, and then you will never cooperate with me again, kind of. But if I cooperate with you, it is costly for me, but it might lead you to cooperate with me. So economists can prove a theorem called the Fock theorem that it is possible to find cooperative Nash equilibrium in the repeated prisoner's dilemma. But the question is, how does one play this game? And this question was asked in an important study by a political scientist at Ann Arbor University in the late 70s, Robert Axelrod. He said, let's have computer tournaments for playing this game. So people sent him computer strategies to play the repeated prisoner's dilemma, and he evaluated them. They paired each other up, and then he announced the winner. And the amazing thing is, even though many of the entries were smart strategies that tried to predict, that tried to deceive, in two consecutive tournaments, the simplest of all strategies won. And the simplest strategy was a three-line computer program sent by game theorist Anatole Rapoport, and it says, it's tit for tat. So I start with cooperation, and then I do whatever you did last round. So without you ever noticing it, you are playing yourself. You are playing yourself once removed, because I do exactly what you did last time. And that strategy at that time was considered kind of a world champion in the prisoner's dilemma, but it has a problem. It has the following problem. If two tit-for-tat players play against each other and there's a mistake, one by accident defects, the other one will hit back. And this endless cycle of retaliation destroys cooperation. So tit-for-tat is unforgiving. But to do well in a world with errors, which was not in Axelrod's tournament, but if you want to think about a realistic world where people make mistakes, you need a mechanism for forgiveness. And tit-for-tat doesn't do that. So in my PhD thesis, I had natural selection run a tournament on the computer and in mathematical analysis and to analyze what is happening if we put it into a context where errors are always occurring and not where we play arbitrary strategies sent by people, but natural selection chooses in spaces of strategies. So I start with a random ensemble of strategies. The first thing that you get is always defect. So if people play randomly, the best thing is to defect. But fortunately for my PhD thesis, it wasn't over here. Something interesting happened. Tit for tat came in. And you can actually prove that tit for tat is a very good catalyst for the emergence of cooperation. It is a harsh retaliator, which you need when almost everybody is defecting to get some small cluster of cooperation going. But amazingly, tit-for-tat was immediately replaced by another strategy. And that other strategy was generous tit-for-tat. There's a formatting problem here. So generous tit-for-tat replaced tit-for-tat immediately. And what is generous tit-for-tat? If you cooperate, I will always cooperate. But if you defect, I will still cooperate with a certain probability. And that's also a recipe how to save many marriages. In the kitchen counter at home, you have dice, you know, and you roll dice, and then you decide whether to forgive or not. And that would be a stable kind of, because you need a probabilistic strategy, because a deterministic strategy could be exploited. So this is a mathematical model for the evolution of forgiveness. But the interesting thing that happened next is, if everybody here plays generous tit for tat and I play always cooperate, I have no disadvantage because everybody is nice and I do never ever retaliate, you know, but that doesn't matter because nobody exploits me. So this is now what is called in biology random drift. I'm a neutral mutant, but there's no pressure for this generous tit for tat like strategy to be maintained. Random drift eliminates it and brings it to always cooperate. It's like birds on an island without predators lose the ability to fly. A biological trait has to be under selection pressure to be maintained. So we drift to always cooperate. But you can guess what happens next. You invite the invasion of always defectors. And you have a simple mathematical model of human history, and people have written books on such oscillations between war and peace. But the interesting thing, in all my work on evolution of cooperation over the last 20 years, I always find oscillations. Cooperation is never stable. There is no stable equilibrium. How much cooperation you get in a system depends completely how long you can hold it and how quickly you can rebuild it after it has been destroyed. And that's what you need in human society. You need structures that rebuild cooperation quickly after it has been destroyed. Because you can bet on it that it will be destroyed. It will always be destroyed. And these oscillations we also see in the oscillations of the financial system, for example. There is a simple rule, and I like simple mathematical results. So this direct reciprocity allows evolution of cooperation if the probability of playing another round is greater than the cost-to-benefit ratio. So the overall mathematics is complicated, but there are some simple rules occasionally emerging. But let me go to indirect reciprocity, because maybe that's even more important for the context of this meeting. So this is a Vincent van Gogh painting of the Good Samaritan. And we don't really know the motive of the Good Samaritan to help this person, but presumably he was not thinking, oh, this is the first round of a repeated prisoner's dilemma, and I should better cooperate here. Instead, the Good Samaritan helps, and maybe the Good Samaritan thinks, I help you, somebody will help me. You know, if I'm in such a situation, somebody might help me. So how do we get indirect reciprocity to work? If you can assign reputation to the players. So here, player A helps B, and then the reputation of A increases. Or A does not help B, and the reputation of A decreases. So then you need natural selection to choose strategies who base their decision to help on the reputation of others. So here we need mechanisms that assign reputation. And the web is perfect at doing such things, and these reputation mechanisms come in eBay auctions and in buying and selling relationships. So there was this was a theory that I worked out with Carl Sigmund in the late 90s, and an experimental confirmation was published in 2000, where people did experiments with students sitting in front of computers and defined that people help those who help others, and helpful people have a higher payoff in the end. What you need for indirect reciprocity is gossip. So people, there's some action going on between two people, others observe it, and then gossip spreads it in the population. And empirical observations suggest that humans are obsessed with gossip. We are talking about others, we are talking with others about others. So people have done experiments in British trains going up and down, listening to what people are talking about. I don't know if that's kind of legal, you know, but 60% of these topics were about indirect reciprocity in a certain sense. So the very interesting thing is, for perfect mechanism of indirect reciprocity, you need human language. So in the human history, you could argue that this was the selection pressure that led to social intelligence and to human language, because you need to understand who does what to whom in a social network, and you need to be able to talk about it. My friend David Hague here at Harvard said beautifully, for direct reciprocity, you need a face, and for indirect reciprocity, you need a name. So there is a lot in our brain that is just there to recognize faces and read intentions into faces and try to understand what people might be doing, but that's not enough for indirect reciprocity. For indirect reciprocity, you need to be able to talk about others. And that seems to be a typical human characteristic. Again, there's a simple rule here, and this is that natural selection can favor cooperation by indirect reciprocity if the probability to know someone's reputation exceeds the cost-to-benefit ratio. So you need mechanisms such that interactions are not completely anonymous. If interactions are completely anonymous, you run into a problem. But you also run into a second problem, and this is that the assignment of reputation, so to say the gossip itself, has to be a game that has to be conducted honestly. So this is on a higher level a cooperation defection problem, which is rarely studied. Almost over. So then spatial selection is just the idea that neighbors help each other. So you get cooperation emerging if cooperators can form clusters. And then clusters of cooperators can prevail against defectors. And this is something we study on graphs. And we have studied this on all sorts of networks, say random regular graphs, random graphs, scale-free networks. And to our great surprise, we found a beautiful, simple mathematical rule that this graph selection favors cooperation if the benefit to cost ratio is greater than the average number of neighbors. So this spatial selection works if you have a few close friends. If you interact loosely with a very large number of people, then it's much harder for that mechanism to work. Something else we did is evolutionary set theory, where people belong to sets, they interact with others in the sets, and they join successful sets. And that is also something that leads to the right spatial structuring that can be a powerful mechanism for cooperators to find each other in sets. So you hear about groups that work well together and you want to join that group, and that can be a powerful mechanism. So the five mechanisms, I discussed three of them, and there are simple rules for all five of them. And these are the cooperators in my group here at Harvard. And recently I wrote a book called Super Cooperators, where I summarize some of these ideas. Thank you very much.
Question for Martin while Nicholas is setting up the slides. But with the spatial selection, one way of thinking about that, I think it's Dunbar's work, which was listening to gossip on trains. And that brings in a whole other issue around privacy, which is the notion of networks. And are our technologies making it possible for us to have much larger networks of stronger ties? So when you said that that the larger networks didn't have the same level of cooperation, was that because they were larger or because they were weakly connected?
So what we call a well-mixed population is a complete graph where everybody interacts with everybody else equally strongly. And this does not provide selection pressure for cooperation. What you want is that you have a few connections with people, and then these are cooperators. But there's a very interesting trade-off, because I can achieve it by saying I only have one friend and we will cooperate and we can never be exploited. But then if there's somebody else showing up, you know, I could increase my overall income by also making this connection. And so we build a bigger network. And what we found in a recent study is that the network, as it becomes bigger and bigger, generates more and more wealth, but becomes more and more vulnerable to the exploitation of defectors. And at the point where the defectors can destroy it, you have the largest wealth. So it's a trade-off between wealth and stability.
Thank you. So I think if Dana was here with the studies on youth, or maybe Zeynep can speak to that, it's basically a model of something that every fifth grade girl has discovered, is that you go through elementary school with one close friend, then you have another close friend, then you have a bigger group, and all of a sudden you have bullies and psychodramas and everything, and you can model it mathematically. Thank you. So,
well, I've tried rather hard to think about how what I'm going to talk about is directly relevant to the theme, and I realized that when I wake up in the morning, I ask myself one question every day, and that is, what I'm doing today, will normal market forces do it? And if the answer is yes, stop. Okay, anything normal market forces will do, I do not want to do, because I believe that normal market forces will do many things, but not the important things. And the ones that I would like to intervene and see happen, hence my whole life is, if you will, in the public sector. I don't look at the private sector. Many people ask me, why didn't one laptop per child cooperate with these CSR programs of big corporations? Well, there tend to be a bad joke. You know, corporate social responsibility is, in the world of philanthropy, in effect, a bad joke, because they are small, they are divided geopolitically, and the real meaning of those is more public relations than making the world a better place. And the public sector is, in the places that you really want to affect, sort of a mess. And so you have, and it's a hard place to deal with. So what I'm going to do is talk to you a little bit about education in the way that we tried to do it with one laptop per child, with the benefit of having done this now for 4 years. I would come to your center, to here, I'd give talks in the early days when it was a wish. It was sort of a dream, a proposition. Now there are 3 million laptops in the hands of kids 5 to 12 years old in 40 countries, 25 languages, growing by leaps and bounds. And those are our laptops. Now there are lots of other laptops, probably 5 or 6 times as many as ours. So even though the number is smaller than I would wish, the number of kids in the developing world that are connected with their own laptop, maybe not one that they can take home like ours, in fact, we make that a requirement, is probably some number closer to 10 or 15 million children. Still not huge, considering that the population of kids that we would want to reach is something like 500 or 600 million. To be at 15 is a step, but not a very big or a complete one. What we have discovered, I think more than anything else, is that everybody who had thought of the use of computers in learning was completely fixated on teaching children, on imparting to children a body of knowledge, and that children would learn through maybe a curriculum, through content. When people tell me the word content, I sort of shiver because I realize that they don't really understand what you want to see happen, and that is you want to see children teaching. And we have in Peru about 1 million laptops in that one country. And I would say as many as 20-30% of those children are teaching their parents how to read. And if that doesn't put goosebumps on your goosebumps, I have nothing else to tell you. But when these kids teach their parents how to read, it completely changes their role in the family, in the village. And that, to me, is the most profound kind of learning, because the self-esteem of those kids, the joy they get out of teaching and the joy they get out of learning, is the one thing you want them to get, not about test scores or memorizing stuff. So when I now use these pictures really like Muzak to sort of remind myself to say things, and also some of them are quite extraordinary. This picture was sent to me recently. I have no idea who this young girl is, but the intensity with which she is focused on what she is doing, and you may notice there's a little hat in the background, which is her baby brother. I just think that the effect on this young girl's life will be quite dramatic. This is a child, again, in Peru. I'm sorry, the images are not higher resolution. We were very often criticized for being too child-centric. And the reason I show this image is because you would like to see this happen all over the world. This teacher had never worked with computers, obviously, but more importantly, the way he taught was that every child was sitting on a little sort of in lines, one behind the other, perfectly still, and it was, you know, corporal punishment was actually part of the curriculum. And this is the way he teaches now. He doesn't teach in any other way. And the kids run to the classroom, and the parents hang in the windows. And that is, again, the kind of learning that you want to see happen. And I think that when the world is a connected world, you're going to see a lot more peace, and that's going to come in part from the elimination of poverty, which could only happen through education. I mean, there are many ways to eliminate poverty, but they all include education. So what I would like to focus on is what might be sort of counterintuitive in this. And I had to give an opening speech at the UN on Monday. And I, as usual, try to take a position that sort of annoys the audience and advocated that sustainability was really a very bad thing. And of course, everybody was trying to make sustainable NGOs. And the reason sustainability is not a good thing in my mind is that it usually leads to very small thinking. And a lot of the so-called NGOs of this world spend a lot of their time in existence and figuring out how they're going to exist and do something micro, feeding itself, and sustainability is an excuse to be small. And sidewalks aren't sustainable. Clean air isn't sustainable. That's not done through an economic model of sustainability that I'm going to do something, earn something. It's done with a much bigger vision. And the next thing that I suggested that was wrong, and I'm going to get into trouble in this group, but I really believe it, and that is I think measurement is wrong. Measuring results is a waste of time. And when people measure results, that means that what they did was so small that the only way you could see it was by measuring, and that the things you want to do in life are big enough that they don't need measurement. And if you're going to eliminate poverty or you're going to build buildings that don't fall down with earthquakes, you don't have to measure just noticeable differences. And that the measurement comes from a process where donors, particularly bureaucrats, are so nervous, they want you to measure the results. Now, I told you there are 3 million laptops out there. Do you know how many the World Bank did? Somebody like to guess? Out of 3 million? Zero. Zero. Now, why does the World Bank do zero? Because they want you to measure the results. And we say, what do you mean measure the results? We can give you some examples. Truancy, which averaged 30% in one country we went to, dropped to almost zero. It was like 1%. No. We want other kinds, and then we want this kind of testing and that kind of testing. Say, you know, come on. You really are changing society in very fundamental ways. So who were the people who did it? Which countries? One country was Uruguay. And the president of Uruguay did it because he had the strength of character. He stood up and he said, every child in my country will have a connected laptop in 18 months. Period. And in 18 months, every child in that country, 500,000 of them today, have a connected laptop. People of the World Bank don't do that because in bureaucracies, if it doesn't go well, you get the blame. And if it goes well, your boss gets the credit. So there's really no sort of incentive. And we looked around at various countries, and the countries that have done it, like Peru, case of Garcia, or Rwanda in the case of Kagame, was always the strength of character of the head of state. So to not take more than my time, I want to show you quickly what we're doing today, only because I don't think I've shown this publicly before. And the first one of these arrived in Jakarta. I haven't even seen it about 3 hours ago. So one of the things we're doing today is which is very different than the laptop. When we built the laptop about four and a half years ago, we had to build the laptop. There wasn't one. Everybody thought it was a silly idea. The industry didn't want it. And so we just had to actually build it. So now we're doing a tablet. And this is the tablet. It's waterproof, covered with rubber. The rubber fits on the back. And you can see sort of images of it. Very simple, be well below $100. Be better than an iPad. It'll be as good as a Kindle in the sunlight. This time, we don't have to build it. This time, we can just threaten to build it. Okay. And all we need to do is show working engineering models, and we can prove that the bill of materials is well below $70, and anybody else is welcome to build it. We might build it too, but anybody. And so all you have to do this time around, because nobody questions it anymore, is to actually threaten to do it. So this is what we're threatening to do. There it is. And I'll use the rest of the time for Q&A. Thank you.
So I'll open it up to the room in a minute. But I have a question, because it brings up one of the themes that I think we've been skirting around a lot today, which is the question of privilege, because one of the issues around privacy is that it's easy to be in public when you're very privileged and when you have a lot of power, and that one of the things that we need to deal with privacy is perhaps protecting the role of the underprivileged or those whose actions and beliefs are not part of the mainstream. And so I was struck with looking at your slides. How many of you have read Sherry Turkle's book Alone Together? Or have heard of it. Most of you have heard of it. It's a phrase. But there's certainly a big resonance in a lot of writing today that when you show well-off children sitting next to each other, each side by side with their screens, it's mm-hmm. shown as this nightmare of contemporary culture, that we don't know how to talk to each other anymore, that we're asocialized and all we do is sit in front of our computers. And when we show a picture like this of school children in a poor community sitting side by side at their screens, the story it tells is of the wonders of technology and the openness of education. I was wondering if you could say something about why do we see these different currents between giving this laptop here, it doesn't make people think, oh my God, why are they doing this? Why can't they talk anymore? And why do we see that same image when we see it with American youth as such a nightmare?
Well, I'm not sure that when I see American or European kids huddled around laptops that way that I think of it as a sign that they can't communicate. And many people say to us, why, you know, if you're doing this, why don't you do it in the United States, and why don't you do it in developed countries? And the answer is that it's, first of all, a much harder problem. It's much harder to renovate a house than to build a new one. And education in this country is such a catastrophe for all sorts of structural reasons. Give you three quick ones, is that there are 15,000 school districts. Another one is it's run on real estate taxes, and the third being that it's based on tests. So you got three fundamental structural problems that change your view of the way kids talk to each other and the way they might use, which make it a much harder problem. So I'm not sure it's so much the social difference or the privilege. It's sort of our education system has got such fundamental flaws that, you know, when I see programs like KIPP or some of the things the Gates Foundation says or Bill says, I say to myself, wow, they just don't see the real issue in our education system. And it's a much deeper problem than sort of alone together, which I think, by the way, is a great title, and Sherry's book may benefit from people using it as an expression in the language where you go out to dinner and your spouse is on the cell phone and you say, sweetheart, we're alone together.
It's great resonance. So I'd like to open this up to discussion. Are there any questions?
Hi. I know that your comments about measurement are something you probably follow more to the spirit than to the letter, but what would be your response to claims that measurement in types of projects such as these increases efficiency? Like, if you know that, you know, one type of model is more effective than the other, then, you know, you can divert more resources towards that, for example.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't in any way deny that that's true. I mean, that's certainly if you measure something and it's like a running race where everybody is just a little bit ahead of each other. And so I'm not arguing against measurement in that case. What I'm arguing against is the kind of projects you do should be so big and the results should be so big and your visions for those results should be so big. And I see so many people in this world, particularly the measurement-prone people, doing these kind of things that aren't that, and then they spend all their energy measuring it. And it just seems to me that it's not to say you shouldn't measure at all or so on and so forth, but the spirit of it is just missing the big changes. And it's the benefactors, the grant organizations all push it. And it's, I just think, wrong. And it's
going back to what you said earlier about preferring publicness, I just wondered, you know, where is anonymous speech in this and the value of anonymous speech in a free society, the value of anonymous sources for journalists? Because it seems to me that there is a great value in publicness and in information being available to everybody. But at the same time, there's also a place for privacy in a democracy, and I wonder if you could speak to that.
Gee, I'd love to defer to somebody who will speak much better to it. That's just, I'm not a student of anonymous speech, one way or the other. I feel I benefit from it. I feel sometimes I see people wickedly hurt by it. But it's, I'm sure, like Jeff Jarvis, I would rather hear from Jeff on it than.
Anonymity is a is part and parcel of free speech. No, the ability to speak in any form and to have that action is absolutely vital to protect. Privacy is vital to protect. Anonymity is vital to protect, and it's related to privacy. My only point is that there's also obviously benefit to publicness, and we talk too much about what bad could happen. And in anonymity, I think it's getting too much of a bad reputation now because of trolls, right? That people are saying nasty things, and if they just stood up behind their names, everything would be okay. And I used to make fun of that. I don't so much anymore. I think one of the insights of Facebook is that real identity and real relationships add value to this. But in any of that, anonymity has an important role in a democracy for sources and whistleblowers and people without privilege who fear being able to speak and being able to connect with other people as a result of anonymity. So it needs to be, it must be protected.
Thank you. I feel like we're law school.
Hi, this is not directed at anyone in particular, but I was thinking about Lisa Nakamura's book, Cyber Types, where she talks about how the, I don't know if anyone's familiar, it's pretty old, but the idea that ideas of race and religion and sort of social norms are translated into an online community. And so even for people, how do I phrase this in the best way? I think that when we're talking about privacy and we're talking about privilege and we're talking about publicness, we're talking about it very much from an ivory tower. Without a realization that there are things that are inscribed in, for example, language and the ways in which we communicate and academic language versus vernaculars that that can really alter how people perform themselves in the online spaces. And I think that's worth thinking about and discussing, that there are processes of education and of imbuing knowledge that don't allow for these to be the kind of free democratic spaces that I think they were possibly envisioned to be. And so when you idealize the public space as a place where everyone can be safe to share their opinions equally without fear of imprisonment, murder, or defamation, that feels really, really far away for me.
Could I ask Nicholas a question? It goes to this measurement idea and this extraordinary description of a whole country with kids with these laptops and your expectation that something really big will result. When will we see it? What will it be? How will we measure? How will we perceive it?
Well, first of all, it's already visible. And you can see in the country, and I urge anybody who's close to Uruguay to go to Uruguay, because I have a friend, some of you may know, he's here periodically to teach, Antonio Batro, who went to Uruguay recently and went to a very poor village on the coast and went into somebody's hut, and the woman had 7 children. And 5 of them had laptops, and they were running their little network at home. And this was a really poor house. And the mothers had just completely taken that, and next year, the 6th one will be 5 years old, and we'll have 6 laptops at home. Those kids are growing up so differently. They all have internet addresses, email addresses at school, Wi-Fi at school, and often Wi-Fi at home. Their curiosity, the way they approach problems, the way they look at things from different ways. They play games, but they own the laptop. So they use it not just a few hours at school. They use it for movies. They use it for all sorts of things. So I think you're going to see a nation in about 10 years, 15 years is the real time when it counts, that is going to be far more creative than many other nations. Uruguay could be the first truly creative nation because kids grew up this way. In between the sorts of things that you might measure, which are being measured, and they measure a lot down there, and you can go to their websites, and if you can read Spanish, you'll find a lot more than I can. But the sort of things they look at is how many kids don't go from, you know, fail the grade they're in and have to stay back a grade. It used to be a relatively significant number. It's almost disappeared. So you get results like that that are pretty interesting measurements. And, you know, make them. But I think that the boldness of doing it is what's going to change the country. And we're going to see things, you know, results that are really quite astonishing. I'll tell you a quick Uruguay story. When Tabaré Vázquez, his name, the president, announced that he was going to do Every Child, it was a teacher who had taught for 30 years in primary school who heard this and said, I've been teaching for 30 years. I'm not going to start teaching with a laptop. And so she went to the Social Security office, and she asked for early retirement. And they said, you know, come back in 10 days, and, you know, it takes 10 days to process it. And in the intervening time, the laptop arrived in her classroom. And within 2 days, she saw the energy of her classroom change. She saw the kids change. She went right back to the Social Security office and said, change that. I want late retirement. And what happened in her class shortly thereafter, she had assigned a project to do something on cows. This little girl goes home, a little disappointed. She hadn't gotten a leg up on the project. And her father said, you know, you're really lucky because tonight our cow is giving birth. And our laptop has a little video camera on it. And so she went and stayed up and filmed the birth of the cow as her project and brought it to school the next day. And of course, it was by far the best project. And the kids collectively figured out how to upload it to YouTube, which they did. And if you type vaca Uruguay or something, it'll come up. And it got 100,000 hits. The teacher said, come on, I never thought my silly homework problem would have 100,000 hits. And again, the self-esteem of the child and all of that. I think those are the things that are the big results. And you get a nation that grows up with kids with that kind of self-esteem and that kind of ease, and you look at it and see something from multiple points of view, and I don't know the answer, I go, fine, let's work on it together, be more collaborative. I mean, you're going to have very few defectors in Uruguay.
Could I ask what programs are actually on your computers, and what are the kids doing with these computers when they get them? How do they know how to use them?
What do you mean, how do they know how to use it? It's genetic. We're going to run a real experiment very scientifically soon where we drop these things out of helicopters into villages that have no schools and see if kids can read after a year. But every kid knows how to open up a laptop and start using it. So using a laptop is really quite simple. What they do with it actually is relatively country-specific by chance. The Uruguayan children tend to use it to surf the web and for entertainment and other stuff. The kids in Ethiopia tend to write computer programs more, and kids in Peru do a lot of book reading.
But
and
all of them are connected to the web?
In our case, I would say of the 3 million, 2 million are connected, 2.5. It's hard.
Yeah. Audience
members trying to. Yes. Somebody's.
So,
yes.
I have a quick question for Martin, I believe, but yeah. Also for Nick as well. So it seems to me these are like two great approaches we've heard. One is build a great tool, of course, with a big vision in mind, the One Laptop Per Child initiative, and see what happens, right? And experiment with it and, you know, make investments and so forth. The other approach is actually to study in a very scientific way human behavior. We had the case of cooperation as an example. And at the end of your talk, you alluded to the possibility of incorporating some of the learnings into the design of institutions. Now, the question is, in a way, that results, at least from me, from this exchange, can we bring the two things together and actually improve? So have the power, the vision, the big ideas on the one hand side, and really also the force to implement, while being still not measuring, but being smart and strategic about it, based on some of the insights that you were talking about, and how difficult is this translation actually from findings in science about human behavior, and then adopting these findings in the design of initiatives, institutions, and strategies?
Yeah, that's a hard question for me to answer, because like listening to your talk, I find it completely amazing that you sort of do something out there, and I'm sitting here asking myself, what do I do out there? You know, so I'm fascinated by understanding mathematics. For me, I want to understand the mathematics of evolution, and I do apply it to questions, say, like human cancer, like virus infections. So we studied the evolution of these processes. We studied the evolution of HIV treatment in 1995. So our mathematical analysis led the medical community very quickly to adopt multiple drug therapy. And now we are doing similar studies for targeted cancer therapy. But in the specific question, maybe in the specific field of cooperation, I think that we would like to bring the mathematical models closer together with experimental observations. So we not only conduct experiments here in the Boston area, in the Harvard Business School, but we sometimes go also to other countries. And then we look at differences. So for example, in our field, many people like punishment. And I'm very skeptical about punishment. I don't think punishment is a good way to actually get cooperation, because it leads to many other problems. So we study reward. And reward works extremely well here in Boston, for example, where people play a public goods game. And then afterwards, they have the option of private interactions. And so they reward those who contributed to the public good. And they do not have a positive cooperation with somebody who withholds cooperation in the public good game. So it works well. Then we go to Romania, and we did the same experiment there. And the outcome was fascinating. People gave up on the public good, but only cooperated in private. They kind of didn't link the two games. And the people there said to us, this makes complete sense, because people distrust that a public situation will ever lead to a productive outcome, but know that in my private interactions, I can count on productive outcomes. And so we could then ask the question, how can we use such insights to help society to lead confidence in public projects? But that's not my.
Okay, yes. Well, I was. My question goes to both Charlie and to Negroponte. I absolutely agree with you that the thing that I hate about privacy is it's always been a sort of afterthought. And it's something that's been in the way of things, and we use the legacy environments that we have are always trying to ease the tension so that something else can happen. And then when I fast forward to the one lap per child, I'm kind of amazed, because one of the huge differences in the question of privacy, in an agricultural society, the question of privacy isn't normally individual privacy, it's usually group privacy, my family, my culture. Because in fact, the group they're so dependent on each other for survival that there can't be privacy. Privacy often gets in the way of the trust that they need. And so in agricultural societies, there's this idea of group privacy. But eventually, in the same kind of afterthought, one lap per child is going to hit privacy barriers around the group. Because as these children link to each other, are sharing information across, they're breaking a kind of natural cultural boundary. And they're taking that culture into a different space. And one question will be, I wonder what the privacy clashes will be, what the harms will look like, and what the space of remedies will be, because they're likely not, they may or may not be the same as ours. And I was wondering if you had any insight in that.
I'm not sure we've had enough experience to have a really deep insight. What we have done, though, is we've taken privacy of the child very seriously. And both in the hardware, so for example, you can't remotely tap into the camera, and you can't remotely record without the child knowing. There's real circuits in there for that. And you can also elect, and this is the government elects the security where if the laptop is stolen, you can disable it and turn it into a brick, and the child can report it as stolen, and that machine is taken out of service remotely, so the child isn't blamed for something that they didn't do. So again, these are technical things that people have thought about and embedded in it, but time is going to tell more. I'm not sure it's so much privacy as the cultural differences that exist today that will not exist tomorrow, and that's a much longer term issue.
Sorry, I really enjoyed the cooperation talk because I think the web, sort of the spread of the internet, has allowed this side of human behavior to be a lot more visible, which I think has really helped break the hegemony of the utility function maximizing individual I've never met. And I mean, according to those theories, Wikipedia is not possible, all sorts of things are not possible. So I'm really curious about how this kind of development of the kind of work you guys are doing in evolutionary biology and sort of human society and analysis is informed by this new visibility of a very basic human fact, this kind of we are cooperative social animals. I like to say we're somewhere between ants and dogs. We don't like to admit it, but that's where we are. So how does that interact with what you observe, what kind of data you use, and does it influence your thinking about this?
So we would we like to compare the human behavior with animal behavior. So we ask what kind of cooperation do we see in the animal world, and how does this agree, or in what sense is human cooperation different? And of these five mechanisms that I mentioned there, all can actually be used by animals to a certain extent, and some actually by animals to a much greater extent. But the one that we have in an unlimited way is the indirect reciprocity, because it ties in with human language. And the indirect reciprocity that we see in the animal world must rely on direct observation, because we do not really have any examples where animals could communicate this information of their own experience. So what humans can do is they don't rely on their own personal experience with someone in order to make a decision whether or not it is possible to cooperate with this person or not. I think the web can help us a lot to distribute this information about people and about companies and institutions rapidly, and to evaluate their actions and to criticize the actions, and then these people have the feeling we are being watched and we have to be careful regarding our reputation.
Depending on how you look at it, the way that the pictures of the laptops have different perspectives depending on how you look at it. So we started out with the assumption that cooperation is often something, well, who is against cooperation? But on the other hand, one of the things to keep in mind is that with all the talk we have of privacy, the cooperation that exists in these models is perhaps in many ways indistinguishable from coercion. So, you know, it's a very interesting piece to look at, because what we have with the web is this infinite reputation, a permanent history where everyone knows everything you've done in every place. It will certainly make you cooperate with the norms of the society. So one of the things we're left with is this question of, is cooperation a good thing? Thank you.